Stay tuned for The Turning Point. So July 4th, I'm looking around at different venues. I'm looking at sports events, looking at different things. And what do I see is, of course, what you see always these days. I guess since 9/11 is you see gigantic American flags everywhere. I mean, you always see a lot of flags, obviously, on July 4th, Independence Day. Independence from who, for what, and for who, that's a subject for another whole show. But July 4th, you see these gigantic flags, and I think it is since 9/11. We see these flags now especially at sporting events, where there are stadiums, football games especially. Flags that are 100 feet by 50 feet, flags that are lit up all over the place, fireworks of flags. I don't think, I really don't know. So here's a comparison based on stone ignorance, which is actually my specialty often here on this show. But I don't really know what it's like in other countries when they have outdoor events. I mean, they're playing the World Cup now. And I watched some of the soccer games called football by the rest of the world. But I watched some of the soccer games and I don't know. I guess I'm not used to it. You have to probably have to watch it for a long time to understand the finer points. But it was somewhat boring to me because of the lack of scoring. But, I mean, maybe that's a typically American. I mean, hockey, which I like, often doesn't have that much scoring. But the possibility of scoring is there all the time. There are shots on the goal. In fact, the soccer reminds me of hockey, of course, because it's got two goalies, two large nets, and you've got a team whose entire point is to come down the court and to to get it past the goalie into the net. So it's just as much like hockey as any game could be. But when I was watching the cup games, the World Cup games, I didn't see you see people, you know, singing the national anthems, and you see people waving flags in the stands, but you don't see gigantic flags unfurled. Maybe that would be considered an insult. I mean, in this country, when two teams are playing, everybody's an American. So there's always military personnel out on the field, or Military Appreciation Day, and we thank our fallen heroes and all of this stuff. And there's always an old veteran of World War II, aren't too many left. And then there's the Korean War, and usually out there with some modern, smart-looking, very soldierly-looking member of the current armed forces, a Marine often. Or somebody from the Army. So, I don't know. I mean, is there any other country in the world that at national events, let's say in Milan, in Italy, when Milan plays Rome, or in England when Manchester plays whatever, I don't know. So internally in each country, do they unravel gigantic flags? I don't really know. I don't know, but there's something more than just being patriotic, obviously, in these gigantic flags. It almost looks like an inferiority complex. And then there's the Star Spangled Banner, which everybody stands up for. When I was listening to all the national anthems, the various national anthems at the World Cup games, and I have to say, half of these national anthems, maybe it's my old age or my cynicism, my weariness, half of the national anthems sound like Deutschland über alles to me. They have this kind of martial, I don't really understand the language always, but they have this martial sound and this kind of collective, mindless, you know, for God, for King, for Lithuania, you know, for Egypt, for whatever it is. For Islam, for Judaism, for the emperor, you know, they have this like this horrible, this horrible sound. Some of them are more moving. The tunes, literally, the music are more moving. One or two things I know about history. I mean, they play the Marseillaise for France, or certainly if they play the Star Spangled Banner, I'm familiar with the fact that these things were based on revolutions by people against imperial powers. And but of course, look what they turned into. In the case of France, within a decade or two, turns into Napoleon, right? So they're playing the Marseillaise with Napoleon being the new oppressor and of his own country and everybody else. But so I'm looking at all the national, I'm listening to the national anthems, and there's the German team, and they're singing their national anthem, and they're not. Well, some of the players are singing it, and. I have to confess to a terrible prejudice, you know, and this happens to me every time I see or hear, like, even if I look at, this is entirely my prejudice and the fact that I come from a different generation and possibly because I'm Jewish, or probably because I'm Jewish, and it was brought up by people like my grandmother and other people, all the older folks, some of whom lost all their relatives over in the Holocaust. To hate Germans. We were brought up this way, the Germans and the Japs. This is how old I am. When I grew up reading comic books and seeing endless war movies which were broadcast over and over again. The entire neighborhood was guys who had been in the service in World War II. Some of them, you know, with still limping from wounds, you know, years afterwards. And had seen combat, a lot of them. And their whole attitude about Germans was generally pretty bad. But certainly in any Jewish family, it was much worse. And my grandmother, who was a harsh critic anyhow, I mean a really harsh critic, she just used to go on about the Germans all the time. And so I look at the German team, and these guys, the average, they run so much, and they tire themselves out so much in soccer, more than any other game, the amount of running involved, that I think the average age is about 26 or 25 they really, I mean, they really have to be young to keep that up, especially in good shape. So I'm looking at a bunch of German guys, and they're singing the national anthem, and they're playing the national anthem. And the national anthem of Germany since 1922 is based on a tune, a little ditty by Franz Joseph Haydn. And you're all familiar with it if you're of a certain age. And if you're not, then you're not. But it's called Deutschland über alles. And it doesn't have the same origin. It doesn't have the same origin. When you think of it, when you think of Deutschland über alles, you think of, if you're in my generation, again, you know, brought up on these movies and watching all these horrible Nazi documentaries, Triumph of the Will. Did you ever see that? The only time I've ever seen flags that were as huge as the American flags that are displayed at sporting events and sometimes at political events are the flags that were shown, the Nazi flags that were shown in these huge events that they would have, these giant rallies that Hitler organized and the Nazi Party organized. The only other time I've seen so many huge flags. I don't know what that means. I have no idea. So I'm looking at these German kids, basically. To me, kids, right? And these kids, they have nothing to do with Nazi Germany. Not one damn thing. I mean, maybe their grandparents were in the war. Maybe not even their parents. Their grandparents might have been in the war and maybe were just soldiers or just drafted or whatever. These kids have nothing to do with it. And yet, I look at it and it's because of the way I grew up. I hear that. I see the names on the back like Schweinsteiger or, Rodensfadelfelden or whatever. And then they have a lot of that very German look. I mean, national characteristics. I mean, you know, some of the French look French. Some of the Algerians look Algerian. I suppose the Americans look American. Some of them. The teams are all mixed races, and they're all pretty well integrated, a lot of them. Although there's a lot of tremendous bigotry in Europe against black players. That's a serious problem with soccer that doesn't exist in the United States. There is out and out vicious racism, which is an international problem with soccer. Because when black players come to play for Italian teams, sometimes British teams, and occasionally French teams, a lot of the white thug, cement head fans jump up and down like monkeys. They throw bananas on the field, this kind of thing. These are players from former colonies of these places. So, you know, the complexity and the irony of all this. But meanwhile, I'm looking at the Germans, and I hear the language, just the German language itself. Just the look of a typical German with the blonde hair and, the rugged face and the erect posture and bearing. And I don't see a 25-year-old German. I see, I don't see this like visually on the surface, but unconsciously it filters into my five senses and leaks into my conscious, though I know better. And I think of Nazis. And so much was I indoctrinated when I was a kid growing up. I mean, we all had daydreams about fantasies, rather, about fighting the Nazis. It wasn't the Japs so much; it was the Nazis. Especially if you were Jewish, you'd fight the evil Nazis and the Germans. And it was that language, when they used that language in all those war movies, movies from the. From the 40s straight until the 60s, right? You will do what? Where are your papers? That kind of thing is typical. I don't know, and I'm sure no younger generation feels that. I'm sure no younger generation feels that. But nevertheless, that's unfortunately what I see, and I have to just put it out of my mind, which I do successfully. But initially, that's what happens. Here's an article that was written a few months ago, in the New York Times. And with my limping throat, I will try to get through it here. A 98-year-old man whose name figured prominently on an authoritative list of suspected Nazi war criminals died over the weekend in Budapest while awaiting trial, his lawyer said. The man, Laszlo Csatari, he's a Hungarian. A lot of Hungarians were very ardent Nazis and joined the army and the party. Was charged in June with having, quote, intentionally assisted the unlawful executions and tortures committed against Jewish people for his role in the deportation of Jews from the ghetto in Kasa, now called Kosice, in eastern Slovakia, according to prosecutors. He had denied the accusations. I'm sure from what I read that he was very guilty. His lawyer, Gabor Horvath, told news agencies in Budapest on Monday that the Hungarian-born Mr. Csatari died in a hospital of pneumonia on Saturday, 98 years old. Mr. Csatari ranked high on an annual list compiled by the Wiesenthal Center of the most wanted Nazi criminals. In 1948, he was tried in absentia and sentenced to death in what was then Czechoslovakia. But according to the Wiesenthal Center, he fled to Canada and obtained citizenship. In 1997, the Canadian authorities accused him of lying to immigration officials about his wartime activities and stripped him of citizenship. He left the country, and people trying to discover his whereabouts lost track of him until he was discovered living in Budapest in 2011. He was detained there, arrested in July 2012. The Hungarian indictment said that, and this indictment was brought by the Hungarian government. The Hungarian indictment said that in May 1944, Mr. Csatari was the commander of a concentration camp in Kosice, where Jews were collected for deportation. Mr. Csatari regularly beat the interned Jews with his bare hands and whipped them with a dog whip without any special reasons or irrespective of the sex, age, or health conditions of the assaulted people, the indictment said. On June 2, 1944, according to the indictment, when a freight train was loaded at the camp with Jews bound for Auschwitz, Mr. Csatari prohibited cutting windows on the wagons, that is, the train wagons, which could have helped about 80 people being crammed under inhuman circumstances in the windowless wagons to get more fresh air. He wouldn't cut windows in there, and a lot of them died of suffocation and heat inside these train cars. According to the Wiesenthal Center, about 15,700 Jews, men, women, and children, were sent to Auschwitz from the Kosice camp and nearby areas in the spring of 1944. The charges against Mr. Csatari reflected a broader debate in Hungary over how to assess the country's role in World War II, when the country was an ally of Germany. A powerful shift to the right has been highlighted by the rise of the far-right Jobbik Party, some of whose members have been accused by critics of anti-Semitism. This is currently now. In 2011, Jobbik championed the cause of another Hungarian crime suspect, Sándor Capiro, 97, who had been accused of participating in a 1942 massacre in Serbia. He was acquitted. Nazi hunters had depicted the prosecution of Mr. Csatari as a bellwether of Hungarian sentiment after the acquittal of Mr. Capiro. Ephraim Zuroff, the director of the Jerusalem office of the Wiesenthal Center and its chief Nazi hunter, described the trial of Mr. Csatari as a way of showing goodwill and doing the right thing. And unsaid in that, of course, is, this is me talking now, not the article, since there is a rise in many European countries of the far right and often of Nazi parties, unbelievably, even in Germany and certainly here, obviously, in Hungary, it becomes even more essential as a symbolic deed to prosecute these old Nazis. But so it's a way of showing goodwill, he said, and doing the right thing. Yes. After word of Mr. Tsatari's death emerged on Monday, Mr. Zurov said his organization was deeply disappointed that he had died weeks before he was to face trial and had ultimately eluded justice and punishment at the very last minute. The fact that a well-known war criminal whose Nazi past was exposed in Canada, this is Mr. Zuroff talking now, the fact that a well-known war criminal whose Nazi past was exposed in Canada could live undisturbed for so long in the Hungarian capital raises serious questions as to the commitment of the Hungarian authorities to hold their own Holocaust criminals accountable. Once again, unsaid by Mr. Zuroff is, and their whole tolerance, I don't know if the government can do anything about it, if it's a democracy, and their whole tolerance of the current, basically right-wing, Nazi-ish movement. Mr. Tsatari's death left nine names on the Wiesenthal Center's list, suspected war criminals living in the United States, Canada, Germany, and Estonia. But Mr. Zuroff said in a telephone interview, they are just the tip of the iceberg. There's no shortage of suspects, he said. What we have to do is find them. Yeah, so that's these old Nazis that they're still chasing. And mostly it's, I don't know who's doing this, older men with the help of younger people. And if it was just old men chasing other old men, it begs all kinds of interesting questions. But, of course, the article makes it clear that there are modern Nazis everywhere. There's no shortage of Nazis or Nazi-like people, unfortunately, everywhere all the time. All you have to do is look all over the world, and you'll see Nazis or Nazi-like organizations, some of which are just purely anti-Semitic. This often happens, actually, when men get together and exclusive of women, when masculinity becomes the ultimate rule, be all and end all, when anything feminine is completely squeezed out and squelched and looked upon with contempt, when weakness is feminine, when strength is masculine, this is when you get this kind of thing.
Ob stürmt oder steigt, ob die Sonne uns lacht, der Tag glühend heiß oder eiskalt die Nacht. Bestaunt sind die Gesichter, doch nur nicht unser Sinn, ja unser Sinn. Es braucht unser Panzer im Sturm mit dahin. Ob stürmt oder scheint und die Sonne uns wacht, der Tag wird heiß oder eiskalt die Nacht. Bestaunt sind die Gesichter, doch froh ist unser Sinn, ja unser Sinn. Es braucht unser Panzer, die Stunde dahin.
Yeah. Now, there's something sickeningly rousing about that to some people. And I apologize profusely and sincerely to anybody who lived through World War II as a combatant in the American Army in Europe, or certainly a profound apology to anybody who was a victim of the Nazis. But I'm playing this as an example of what happens when the masculine principle gets completely out of control. And then any kind of insane testosterone-fueled bigotry or prejudice organized then and becomes so huge and becomes a huge political party or becomes the government itself, this is what you get. Or it becomes a kind of a tribal way of looking at all things. And you just have to sort of look at history and see how that works. So, yeah, there's no shortage of current Nazi-like parties and men behaving like Nazis in various places of the world. Also, you got to be careful when you throw around the word Nazi. If I use the word Holocaust, if I use the word victims, if I use the word, even if I discuss Jews in World War II, if I use the word Nazi, especially, people throw that word around all the time. When I was on Sirius radio, I used to get carried away, and occasionally I think I did on this station once or twice in my life, where you start seeing people who were very right-wing, whose attitudes are, let's get rid of all the immigrants, we're not going to allow any, no more Muslims are allowed in the United States, we need to burn down all the mosques. People who walk around, carrying American flags and arm themselves with AR-47s or whatever they are. And, their attitude is completely white supremacy. And some of them are crazy and some of them are just plain dangerous. And they're anti-Semitic, too. So I would often refer to them as Nazis. And I got a lot of complaints from people. People don't like it when you use the word Nazi in any kind of form, because the Nazis were the Nazis. But obviously, there's things about them that there are themes that and characteristics that continue, that flow through all this. But so there are current Nazis. But what about those old Nazis? What about the ones like the man that died, Mr. Tsatari here? The director of the Wiesenthal Center, which is the international group that hunts Nazis, from World War II. These are not just German soldiers, although eventually they may get down to it. If they run out of camp commandants and they run out of high-level officers, like people who were majors or colonels or captains in various places that exceeded their authority and people witnessed them just gratuitously murdering men, women, and children, just shooting them to death. When they run out of people, eventually, what happens when you reach the last Nazi, the last actual Nazi, member of the German, Reich during from the 1930s to 1945? What happens when you reach the last one who is guilty of these crimes? And it just makes you think about what your goal is, about what these people's goals are. Their goal is clearly that if suddenly after World War II the world was a peaceful place, if suddenly after World War II, a lot of people thought this after World War I, that there was going to be peace in our time, that would be the last war. Many people actually believed that, although a lot of soldiers and a lot of people who understood human nature thought there would be another war within 20 years, and of course they were all right. But people thought after World War I, which is these days, it's I think it's roughly the 100th anniversary of many battles and the beginning of World. I think the beginning of World War I and many famous battles in World War I. People thought that was it. There couldn't possibly be the destruction of tens of millions of people. The way soldiers' lives were thrown away in the tens of thousands in these mass assaults on machine guns and the shelling, which drove people out of their minds. Whole parts of Europe were destroyed, just blown to pieces. People thought, well, that could never happen again. Well, it happened again, and it happened even worse. And then civilians, in fact, there were relatively few civilians, despite all the propaganda on the Western side. There were relatively few civilians who were especially picked out and designated as subhuman or criminals or whatever of the human race and rounded up and murdered like in World War II. So World War II was a lot worse, and the main reason it was worse was not just the technical improvements and the way people were destroyed by more powerful and more expansive weapons, but also the picking on the complete disregard of civilian life, utter and total disregard of civilian life, and picking out, singling out the gypsies, homosexuals, intellectuals, Jews, that kind of thing. So it's a whole different thing. But these Nazis, these old guys, there's something about it. So if this makes you very upset for me to say this, you feel free to contact me. You can always go to my website, Fader Files. And there's a way to contact me that way. But there's got to be a limit. What happens when you reach the last Nazi? You see this, one of them was 97, the other one's 98. And a lot of the people, Wiesenthal himself, you know, people survive World War II. People get older. Now, if somebody, and they're way in their 80s and 90s now, these people, the significant Nazis, the Nazis were who were in command or who planned these things and carried these things out, like Mr. Tatari here, who is responsible for, and, you know, there are, you know, hundreds of witnesses still, you know, existing, or at least dozens. The people who planned this stuff, the people who carried it out, the camp commandants, the people who were in charge of the freight and the rail switching lines. These people need to be brought to justice. I believe they should be brought to justice. And what is justice? That all depends on your point of view, I suppose, in terms of capital punishment. To me, justice for these people, for a guy like this, you shoot him to death. You hang him. A public execution. Now, I think a lot of people are unalterably opposed to capital punishment. I think there are some cases where I think this is what needs to be done to people for the reasons which, I don't know, we could discuss capital punishment another time, but for people who have done, for men who have done this kind of thing, capital punishment needs to be public, and it needs to show the world this is what happens to people. And I guess you could throw somebody in jail for the rest of their life in solitary confinement, Something awful has to happen. But what happens when people get older is the horrors of such things, like World War II now. People, if you see veterans marching in parades or veterans of World War II, a lot of them can't walk. They're in their, I think you can't be anything. You have to be at least 87 or 86 or 87 years old, maybe 87, 88, 89 years old to have actually participated as a combatant in the United States Army or Navy or the Air Force or the Marines. You have to be at least 87 years old to have been in World War II. In Germany, they forced a lot of teenagers, Hitler Youth, and they just grabbed a lot of teenagers, kids who were 14, 15, 16. So maybe the age is 81 or 82. But these people are dying off. And horrors fade. Evil itself seems to fade, and it's sort of a natural way of the human being protecting themselves finally against being overwhelmed constantly and becoming paralyzed by these things. These horrible deeds, as horrible as they were, and they're indescribably horrible from World War II, they tend to fade as the events recede into history and as people get older and die. But if you go back far enough at a certain time, there was a movie, I think it was in the late 70s or mid-70s, based on a novel called Marathon Man, which is a terrific movie, by the way, with Dustin Hoffman and a lot of other really terrific actors. Laurence Olivier, who played Joseph Mengele, one of the most famous and horrifying Nazis of them all. It's 1976 or something that this was the novel was written and the movie was made. Maybe it was the early 80s, but probably in the late 70s. And that was very much alive in people's minds. Mengele, I won't tell you the whole thing, but he somehow winds up in Manhattan. And he is recognized by people, you know, and at that point there were still tens of thousands of high-level serious Nazis running around the world, hiding from people or being sought mostly by the Israeli, government and by the Wiesenthal Center. And so there's a scene, for instance, in Marathon Man, where an older man, a man in his 60s, his late 60s, maybe early 70s, is chasing after another man. He gets angry at him because there's a traffic problem. And that man rolls his window down, and he's an old German. And the man chasing him is an old Jew from New York City who had been alive in Europe during World War II. And they get into a screaming match, and the old Jew is screaming, you know, because the German rolls his window down and starts cursing the guy behind him calling him, Juden this and Juden that, cursing him that he's Jewish. And the guy curses back, "You old Nazi, you son of a bitch." And they wind up, I won't tell you, but they wind up smashing into each other. So what happens is, and the whole movie has meaning that it wouldn't have now. You couldn't make a movie that now because it would almost be ludicrous or silly, or it wouldn't really make much sense to entire new generations. Obviously, the place where this is preserved way beyond generations is in Israel. And in some ways, Israel is a kind of a living monument to what happened in World War II. I mean, the state of Israel itself, the people who founded it, the very buildings, the stones, the memorials in Israel. It's like a foundation memorial, like a monument to what happened in World War II. So as long as there's Israel there, but there's something about Nazi behavior, and I said, this article made it clear that Nazi behavior persists all over the world. It's still there, which is one reason to pursue these people, to show, to make it clear, to make it evident all the time. But you can't keep doing that. You keep chasing these people. You keep chasing them. Now, I don't want to make some kind of absurd generalization or comparison here, but it's the same thing inside yourself, internally. If you have a terrible superego and you have demons inside yourself that are left over, and you're older and you're older and you're older, that are left over from childhood, these Nazis inside you, which survive from your childhood, these Nazi-like figures or these Nazi attitudes which condemn you, which are based on maybe the way you were treated when you were young, when you were a victim of some miniature little tiny Holocaust in your own house and by people who were brutal or people acted in a brutal, way. These things, if you keep preserving them way into older age, they freeze you. They make you rigid. This is obviously a theme I talk about all the time. There's a tyrant in there, and you feed the tyranny inside your own self by acting constantly like a victim. And if the secret, I think, or one of the secrets to letting go or, getting rid of these Nazis inside yourself, in your own mind, in your superego, is not to feel so much the victim. Because as long as you feel like you're a victim, it gives strength and it gives fuel to the Nazi elements which exist inside yourself. But I mean, that's inside, that's an internal thing. That's a psychological or spiritual way of looking at something. But there are real, we're talking about real Nazis in the world. There's something tyrannical in the human race, especially if you look at when men get together. There's something tyrannical, and I don't know, does this have something to do with the fact that they don't bear and rear children the way women did throughout history and still do a lot? Something about the separation between them and bearing and carrying children and keeping children alive when they're babies. Mr. Engineer, how much time we got left there? Okay. There's something about the human male and about the human race that brings out the Nazi in people's souls. Now, not everybody is going to become somebody like this. Some people will fight them. Some people will be disgusted by them. And yet, when you look all over the world, and you look in this country too, and you look in other countries, people who belong to right-wing political parties, people who belong to often to the police or to the army, in countries all over the world, and you could see it everywhere. And look what's going on in Syria right now. I mean, there is a Nazi for you. There is a Hitler right there. And he has ardent supporters. There are people in various countries, in various parts of the world, who would, in fact, extinguish whole other groups of people in their millions just because they are a different sect of the same religion, or because they're Jews, or because they look different, or they're a different skin color or something. And these people who, and there are a lot of people who have charismatic personalities, who draw to them all of these people. They draw all these people to them. And there are millions and millions of men in the world. And in this country, I think sometimes there are women now, but there are millions and millions of men. This is where you get in trouble, right? Am I saying that there are anything, there's anything Nazi about the American army or the American government? Maybe I am. Maybe I am. Who is immune from this kind of stuff? Who is immune from this kind of behavior, especially a professional soldier who has political points of view and maybe brings some bigotry into his work? I mean, look where we are in the world now. You've got an essentially white-controlled, from the top, army, although a lot of the soldiers are not white now. And now there are women soldiers. But you've got an essentially older, male, white-dominated Christian army at the top. And they send these people into places all over the world where people are different religions. So they're Muslims. They're a different skin color, usually some shade of brown or tan. And, you know, there's this, there are elements about these things that that persist. This element that if you just put your boot down long enough and hard enough and squash all these people, that you will be that you're justified in doing it, and the world will be saved. I don't know. I mean, Freud had an attitude in Civilization and Its Discontents. His attitude was that, or one of his themes was, that the world, and he was looking at it before the true horrors of the concentration camps. Freud died before the true horrors of the concentration camps were revealed to the whole world, although he knew very well, like anybody else, what was going on. And he fled Vienna in 1938. But he saw the Nazis for what they were, and he said that the world was in a race between what he called eros and thanatos, between love and death, between love and death. The world was in a race between love and death. And he didn't really seem to be too sanguine, to use an old-fashioned word. He didn't really think, if it was a horse race, that love was going to win out. Now, I don't know what the reason for that was. Maybe he was a naturally kind of gloomy fellow. He was older then. He had cancer. It was coming to the end of his life. He was in pain. But he saw the Nazis, and he had lived through all kinds of other things, too. Freud was born in 1856, I think. And he had lived through World War I. He had lived through, and he had seen, and he had read about, a very learned man, obviously, read about anti-Semitism. He had relatives who probably had been victims of anti-Semitism. And the pogroms and all the anti-Semitism in Europe. He had seen all this, and then he had studied what else happened in the world, too, other wars. The history of the world is the history of, sometimes if you look at it a certain way, of not just of evolution and improvements and progress, but the history of the world is just as much the history of murder, mass murder, wars, hatred, organized hatred, Nazi behavior. So this, and people say this about the Germans sometimes, and this is possibly, you know, a stereotype, or probably a stereotype. Now, how can people who produce all these wonderful inventions, I mean, a lot of things, you know, that are life-saving inventions, medicine and various kinds of various kinds of medicine that have saved tens of millions of people have been produced in Germany. Technological improvements to things, which you know, which are extraordinary, and also produce some of the most beautiful, lyrical, haunting love songs and melodies and music and beautiful poetry and plays. And people say this is an old-fashioned thing. How can a people who do this produce people like you know, the Kaiser and all its minions and von Ludendorff in World War I in this kind of crazy Nazi behavior that that wound up killing something like 30 or 40 million people in Europe, all over Europe, including in Germany. 6 million people died in Germany, something like, you know, civilians and soldiers, 5 million soldiers. How can they produce the same thing? They were a perfect crystallized example of what Freud said was thanatos versus eros. And there's no way of knowing. But here we have real men in the world. This guy, Sattari, who died at the age of 97. And you wonder, though, the old guys, who works in the Wiesenthal Center? Who works with these guys? Now, a lot of these men are too old to even do this job anymore, but they were victims of the Nazis, and their families were victims of the Nazis. They live, a lot of them live in Israel, and they are, and Israel is a, you know, devoted, it's like a living monument to this kind of thing, and they will bring it up at the drop of a hat, and why shouldn't they? Sometimes they bring it up in a manipulative way, but sometimes they bring it up in a perfectly just way. They know, and they are living survivors of what the world has done to Jews in the world, you know, what the world has done to the Jews. And if they want justice, let them have justice. There needs to be justice. But I'm just asking, I'm only asking here, what happens finally? There's going to be a last Nazi. So what happens to the people who are chasing the Nazis? I know they have the help of younger people. They have to, or else they couldn't function. There's got to be people in their 50s, 40s, maybe their 30s, who have reasons to of their own to chase after these old Nazis and catch them. And this guy Zuroff, who is the head of the office in Jerusalem, says that that it's just the tip of the iceberg, and he says there's plenty more where they came from. Really? Are there really? If you start reducing it, am I defending the Nazis? Of course not. Only if you start reducing the level of crime, and it justifies the existence of a lot of these old guys who are chasing the Nazis. One day there will be none of these actual German World War II era Nazis to chase. And if you're old and you've been chasing them your whole life, you'll probably wind up when the last one is killed off or the last one is brought to justice, dying almost instantly yourself, because your whole purpose in life is revenge and justice. You could call it either one, and you would be right in both cases, I suppose. But I don't know. What are you going to do? You can't just give up. I mean, here's the question. What do you do about this kind of evil in the world? What can you do about this kind of evil in the world? It existed in this astounding, overwhelming, so far unmatched form in World War II, in the German government and in the German army. And all the flags were waving, just like on July 4th, the gigantic flags. The boots were stomping. The men all got together with their tankards of beer. And they went out in the world and they murdered tens of millions of people in the concentration camps, in Russian towns and villages, in towns and villages, resistance fighters, just innocent citizens in France, in Holland, all over the place. Great mass murderers, the Germans in World War II. And something, can you forgive? Can this be forgiven, finally? In South Africa, they had the Truth and Justice Commission. I don't know if it can be forgiven. I really don't know. Maybe ultimately it can't be forgiven, but it could just be forgotten, and it will be forgotten. In the end, the horrors of things tend to fade as the events recede. I mean, it just, things cannot last forever. But still, you have this right-wing party in Hungary now. You got a right-wing party in Germany, right-wing party in France and in Italy and some other places. And you think to yourself, what do you do about this stuff? What do you do about this stuff? You can't ignore it, because if they take over, it'll be just like Nazi Germany all over again. So you're bound to fight it. But you get weary. You get weary, and you say to yourself sometimes, you say, when is it ever going to stop? Could it ever stop? I mean, either you have to fight this stuff, or you have to turn your back on it, or you do the best you can. I think one way to fight this is not actively to fight it, although that's what a lot of people do. Certainly, if you listen to this station, or if you're involved in left-wing politics, you do feel like you're fighting this kind of thing. Sometimes the best you can do is, if you don't want to fight it and spend your entire life seeking revenge and justice and fighting against this incessant evil, which seems to be the history of mankind, the best you can do is express some kind of love in the world. Locally, just in your, if you have a garden, if you have just people in your family that you do things for, if you can just play music, you know. I know somebody who travels all over the world with his band playing music for people and entertaining people. If you could just bring some light into the world, it's a way of fighting this kind of incessant evil. Will it be ever, will it ever be over? I don't think so, unfortunately. And so we have to figure out the way that we fight it.
Along the road to sweet Athy, hurroo, hurroo. Along the road to sweet Athy, hurroo, hurroo. Along the road to sweet Athy, a stick in my hand and a spot in my eye. I heard a doleful damsel cry, Johnny, I hardly knew you, with your guns and drums and drums and guns, hurroo, hurroo. With your guns and drums and drums and guns, hurroo, hurroo. With your guns and drums and drums and guns, the enemy nearly slew you, and you look so queer, my darling dear. Johnny, I hardly knew you. Where is the eye that looked so mild, hurroo, hurroo? Where is the eye that looked so mild, hurroo, hurroo? Where is the eye that looked so mild, that my poor heart you first beguiled? Why did you skedaddle from me and the child? Johnny, I hardly knew you, with your guns and drums and drums and guns, hurroo, hurroo. With your guns and drums and drums and guns, hurroo, hurroo. With your guns and drums and drums and guns, the enemy nearly slew you, and you look so queer, my darling dear. Johnny, I hardly knew you. Where is the leg with which you run, hurroo, hurroo? Where is the leg with which you run, hurroo, hurroo? Where is the leg with which you run, when first you left to carry the gun? Oh, I feel your dancing days are done. Johnny, I hardly knew you, with your guns and drums and drums and guns, hurroo, hurroo. With your guns and drums and drums and guns, hurroo, hurroo. With your guns and drums and drums and guns, the enemy nearly slew you, and you look so queer, my darling dear. Johnny, I hardly knew you. Well, you haven't an eye, you haven't a leg, hurroo, hurroo. You haven't an eye, you haven't a leg, hurroo, hurroo. You haven't an eye, you haven't a leg, an eyeless, boneless, chicken-less egg. And you'll have to be put with the bowl to beg. Johnny, I hardly knew ya. With your guns and drums and drums and guns, hurroo, hurroo. With your guns and drums and drums and guns, hurroo, hurroo. With your guns and drums and drums and guns, the enemy nearly slew ya, and you look so queer, my darling dear. Johnny, I hardly knew ya. Well, I'm happy for to see you home, hurroo, hurroo. I'm happy for to see you home, hurroo, hurroo. I'm happy for to see you home, all from that island of Ceylon. So low in the flesh, so high in the bone, Johnny, I hardly knew.